Good afternoon. This is Kathleen McCoy, and you're listening to Hometown Alaska. Our topic today is the Port of Anchorage, which was just in the news on Monday, right? There's so many questions about the port. This is a great opportunity for us to air the issues and hear from experts. Among the questions we have are, how did a project go from a $360 million project in 2005 to a $1 billion project today? How did the timeline change from 2011 to 2021? Who's responsible for what went wrong? Is this a good design for the Port of Anchorage? And will we ever get our money back? These are big questions, but we've got some great heads in the studio with us today to talk about them. I'd like to welcome Stephen Rabufo.
That's right.
Deputy Director for the Port. Hi, Stephen.
Good afternoon.
And also Larry McAllister, who's here with us from the Army Corps of Engineers. Welcome, Larry.
Good afternoon.
And then later in the show, we expect to hear from Mayor Dan Sullivan, who couldn't be in the studio with us, but plans to call in and take questions as well. So now, let's see. I'd like to just tell people a little bit more about my guest because, you know, they know where you work, but they don't know that much about you. Now, Larry, I got a beautiful bio from Larry, and he's a civil engineer at heart. Deeply, deeply a civil engineer. And also, I read that you were responsible for projects in Iraq that were way more expensive than this one, I guess, in total. So you're not afraid of big projects, I guess.
That's true.
And then I learned from Steve that he's been at the port 4 years, Steve?
A little over 4 years.
And your background is in military?
I spent the first 30 years of my life after getting out of college in the Air Force and retired in summer of 2007 and got the opportunity to come back to Alaska and grabbed it.
And the job of the deputy port director is?
Well, generally speaking, the job of the deputy port director is to pay attention to the business of the port on a day-to-day basis and make sure that the staff is doing what needs to get done in our landlord role down there, and also to keep the relationships, the working relationships going with the tenants who are down there, and look for opportunities to grow the business.
So I know that this should be of great interest to our listeners, so I want to make sure they know how to reach us, ask you questions, ask the mayor questions. They can call in today at 550-8433. Or if you're outside Anchorage, and we've made the point that this is the port for Alaska, not just the port for Anchorage, you can call 1-888-353-5752. Or you can also send us an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org, and we often try to read those on the air and answer those questions. This program is going to air again this evening at 7 p.m., but people won't be able to call in. And lastly, I just want to folks to be mindful of our website, alaskapublic.org, where we have a lot of links related to the port. We've got a slideshow where you can hear Governor Sheffield sort of discussing the port. We've got some Anchorage Daily News coverage. We even have the newest memorandum of agreement that the mayor has sent off to the legislature explaining how things are changing at the port now that there's more oversight. So, but I want to go back to Steve, because I'm pretty sure people don't really have a full sense of what goes on at the Port of Anchorage. And I want to give them a little bit of an overview. How does it work? When do the ships come in? What goes on?
Sure. Well, you know, it's interesting when you're in a logistics business, your biggest marker of success is that people don't even know you're there. and I think we suffer a little bit from that. You know, the port is, it's on Kinnick Arm. Really at the northernmost part of the city of Anchorage, off the beaten path. No one drives by it every day. And if you're not paying attention, you wouldn't even know it was there. And you know, we give these summer tours. We have for the last 3 years. And when we first started giving these, it was quite a surprise to find out how many people didn't even know we had a port. I think based on the numbers of hot dogs and drinks and bags of chips we've given out over the last 3 years, that we know there's at least 15,000 people that know we have a port, and hopefully that number will grow and grow. We've put some new commercials on TV to kind of get the word out there that, yeah, there is a port in Anchorage, and look how important it is not only to the Anchorage Bowl, but to 80% of the state.
Yeah. Now, I wanted to, speaking of tours of the port, I got a tour last Friday from Lindsay Witt. I wanted to give her a shout out and say thank you. That was so great to get to see it. And in addition, I wanted to thank the Anchorage Daily News because I relied a lot on some of their coverage from January and May. So, you know, I really appreciate that those things were out there in the public record for us to rely on. And thanks to Lindsay also. So I I know. Here's my question. I wanted to know, when do the ships come in? Because there's a real routine to that. When do they come in? Well, when does our ship come in?
Sure. Well, there is and there isn't a routine. It just depends on what type of commodities we're talking about. Container ships, for example, which is what most people think about when they think of the stuff you find on store shelves and the like. The container ships, two shipping companies who are residents down at the port, Totem Ocean Trailer Express and Horizon Lines, they bring their container ships in twice a week on Sundays and Tuesdays, and takes them anywhere from 16 to 22, 23 hours to offload.
Wow, and it's a full day.
Yeah, and away they go. Well, they're offloading and then they're unloading for the backhaul. Totem Ocean Trailer Express runs their route strictly between Tacoma and Anchorage, but Horizon Lines makes stops in Dutch Harbor and Kodiak on their backhaul trips.
So they might be taking some things that arrived in Anchorage.
They'll take some stuff from here and go down to Kodiak with it. Now, aside from container ships, we do a pretty robust refined petroleum business. There are petroleum tenants down at the port, Flint Hills Resources and Crowley, Anchorage Services International Group that runs the consortium out at the airport, and Tesoro. So they are on a less regular schedule, but frequent and recurring, particularly during the spring and summer months, and now late into the fall, bringing petroleum barges and tankers into the port.
Now, Steve, we have a caller, and it's right sort of on that question of tenants. Hello, Dick.
Good afternoon.
You're on Hometown Alaska. What's your question?
Well, I remember when this port expansion was first discussed that the major container companies were not enthusiastic about expanding the port because they perceived that their cost of doing business would go up, and they felt that what they had for facilities was sufficient for their needs, didn't need an expanded area. And I'm curious about the projected revenue requirement to cover bonds or whatever has to be repaid down at the port, as to how much of it gets ends up being stuck on the throughput of the shippers. And
how about we tackle those two?
Okay, well, actually, I got three.
And how much comes from new areas?
Okay. So, Steve, go ahead.
All right. Well, let me see if I can't get back to the beginning and understand the part about misgivings on the part of the
shippers.
Having not been there from the very beginning, I can at least impart my experience in the time I've been there. And I think it's safe to say that we appreciate that there are some concerns that the shippers have voiced to us. Some of them, and most of them, I should say, were in the areas of being able to safely operate out of a new berth. And was the berth infrastructure going to be adequate for them to be able to safely operate? We've listened and taken to heart all the concerns that both Totem Ocean Trailer Express and Horizon have had, and are working all of those into the design. They are partners in figuring out what the right configuration is for where it is they're going to be operating down there at the port.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I know from what I read, Tote offloads by just, what do you call that? Just drive off?
It's called a roll-on, roll-off, or row-row. It's interesting, and that's what people enjoy when they come out on Sundays for the tours, is that in the container ship world, there are two different kinds of operations. There's a lift-on, lift-off that uses container cranes.
And which is Horizon.
Right, which is what Horizon does, and the roll-on, roll-off, which is you literally drive the cargo on and off the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have both of them, and people get to see both of those operating simultaneously.
Very cool.
When they come down.
Yeah. Now, Larry, don't fall asleep over there, because we've got questions for you too.
So. I'm good.
Now, I wanted to also talk a little bit about the cost of the expansion project as it relates to the folks, the tenants down at the port.
Okay.
And we may be focusing on Tote and Horizon right now, but because it's 129 acres of active property down there, you can't ignore the fact that there's other people conducting business every day as well. And what we have always promised all of the stakeholders down at the port is they will not bear the burden of the cost of the expansion project. Nobody is taxing them in any way, shape, or form in order to pay the bill.
The tenants.
The tenants. As far as bonding goes, conveniently, we're a department in the municipality of Anchorage. We can only bond to the extent that we are, that our revenue streams authorize us to. And there's plenty of checks and balances in place that would prevent us from thinking we could bite off more than we can chew.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you that the chief financial officer in the municipality of Anchorage is not going to let us bite off more than we can chew.
Right. Yeah. You know, we started. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, Dick. Did we answer your questions, Dick?
Well, who pays for it then? I mean, if you have a billion-dollar port, how much of that is federal gifts and how much are state?
That's fair. The way we have funded it thus far, and the way we intend to continue to fund it, is we've gotten grants from the federal government, particularly from the Safety Lou Bill in the past, and from the Department of Defense, because we're one of 19 national strategic ports and have an obligation to the DOD to be able to support their mission here in Alaska. We also get state grants. The port has a certain amount of debt that we can float, plus we contribute out of our revenue stream every year. At the end of the day, we think it's going to be about a 50-50 split between federal and state and local.
Okay. So thanks, Dick, for that call. I think it's one that's on everybody's mind. So, and I'm sure we'll hear more about it from the mayor when he joins us in the second half of the program. Back to sort of one of the things I learned about the port is that it's an enterprise department for the city, which changes its relationship. It's not really like the city's it's a child of the city that the city keeps alive. It's actually pretty independent, makes money for the city.
Correct.
And probably changes the relationship between the port and the city since, that you know, I know from working in newspapers, the ad side brought in the money and the news side spent it.
There's five of us. MLNP, AWWU, Solid Waste, Merrill Field, and the port are enterprise/utility functions that fall underneath the municipality. So you're absolutely right. We generate all of our own revenue to pay all of our own way down there. No property tax dollars come down to run the Port of Anchorage. We're self-sufficient, and so much so that we pay a fee in lieu of taxes to the city every year to help run government.
Right. So that's kind of that was an interesting thing for me. I thought that might change the relationship between the mayor, the assembly, and the port when you guys are bringing in the bucks. I want to talk more about the port, but I really want to bring Larry in here since we've got him from the Corps of Engineers. This is an interesting place for a port to be. Some of the reading I did showed that in 64, this port did better than the other two ports, which I think we're talking Seward and Whittier, that it kind of survived as the main port after the earthquake. But there's still lots of issues with it being where it is. And so I thought the Corps, I know, does annual dredging. That isn't ever going away as far as I know. So could you tell us a little bit about maintaining this port?
Sure. The Corps of Engineers has responsibility under several federal laws, the River and Harbor Act, the Water Resources Development Act, Energy and Water Development Act. All those are fairly known public laws that says the Corps is responsible for maintaining dredging at 100% federal funding of certain ports around the country. And we do more than just Anchorage Harbor. We actually do dredging at some other ports around the country, around the state. Dillingham is one, Homer is another one, et cetera. And the interesting thing about this particular port is that we call it operation and maintenance. The operation and maintenance budget for this port is on an annual basis is somewhere between $12 and $18 million a year to maintain that port.
Is that just the dredging, or
just
is that
the dredging?
The pilings.
You don't even deal with
dredging. Pilings, yeah.
And the reason for the dredging is because of the, as you heard Steve mention, is that the Kinnick Arm waterway, it's Kinnick Arm Glacier, all the silt that comes in on that, the high tidal fluctuation, all of that deposits debris on there on a continual basis. If you've ever walked down to the river, the inlet is not clear like ocean. It's silty, so there's lots of stuff coming in through there. Big boulders get washed down through there on a regular basis, gravel, silt, et cetera, clays. And so every year we're authorized to maintain what is called minus 35 feet mean lower low water, MLLW, which is a fancy way of saying that at the low tide, we're authorized to go 35 feet below low tide so that you can get the ships in there. We maintain up to the edge of the dock, within 5 feet of the dock. And for the maintenance dredging, we go out about 1,800 to 2,000 feet every year.
So this happens in April?
It starts in the May time frame, as soon as the ice frees up and we can get the dredgers in there. They're stationed in the lower 48. They obviously can't maintain them and stay up here over the winter. They come in and they will go until the last possible minute, and generally that's probably around October time frame before they actually have to leave.
So do they rotor-rooter out the Kinnick arm for us?
It depends. There's two different types of dredging. There's a hopper dredger, which basically sucks the stuff off the bottom like a giant vacuum and then deposits it, and then they take the debris out. And then there's just big clamshells where they just reach down in there, huge scoops of dirt come up, and they put it in a dredge or a barge, and they ship it off someplace and dump it.
Wow.
So we use both of them out here. Now, the other interesting part you ask about dredging is because of the new construction, there was an authorization several years ago because now you've moved the potential port out 400 some feet into the waterway.
Right.
All that has to now be dredged. So we got authorization and funding through the ARRA program, which for those who are not familiar with that term, that's the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, the stimulus bill, if you will.
Stimulus money, okay.
So we've got $27 million to do what we call transitional dredging, which is to basically make sure that the north end of the dock, which has been, the landfill has been pushed out that far. We've been doing that dredging now for the last 2 years, just completed that work this October for about $27 million.
Is that going to be an annual fee?
Well, that's, again, the maintenance dredging will now be responsible for doing the maintenance dredging of that on an annual basis.
In addition to what you were doing before.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
And you're projecting that it might be $27 million a year?
No, the transitional dredging, because that's never been dredged before, it was a virgin material. You really had to go down deep. And that's when if people went down to the port on a tour, they saw this big, huge bucket crane out there working all summer long. And I understand it was one of the largest dredgers in the world.
Well, that's the way we like it in Alaska.
Everything's
bigger.
Big.
Right.
So it was successful. It got all the debris out that we could get out. And that contract ended on the 21st of October. And I think I've got a number here somewhere. I think they pulled out about 2.6 million cubic yards of silt and sand.
And now that's not going in to fill the cells. That just gets...
Right.
We're getting land somewhere else to fill the cells of the expanded port. We're going to get into the whole expanded port, too.
Yeah.
But I didn't think most people realized how much, maintenance work has to happen to keep this port viable for us. And now with the additions, there's some other things that have to be added in. I want to let people know the Port of Anchorage is our topic today on Hometown Alaska. And we have two great, good thinkers and heads here to answer your questions. We've got Stephen Rebuffo, who's the Deputy Port Director, and Dr. Larry McAllister, who's with the Army Corps of Engineers. And we expect to hear from Dan Sullivan in the second half hour by phone. So let's see. Let's go back to sort of talking. I guess I'm ready to get to the design. Let's talk about this is the big transition that the port made, as you said, from a quiet neighbor that nobody actually really, they were doing their thing. There's lettuce on the grocery store shelves. You can, get your car, you can get what you need. So people didn't think about the port. But now we got a new port director in 2001, former Governor Bill Sheffield, and things began to change then. And I know you weren't quite there yet, Steve, because you didn't get there till 2007.
Right.
But back in 2001, Bill Sheffield came on and began thinking bigger thoughts about the port. One of the questions I have is there pressure for the port to grow? Is there a need for it to grow? Is there increasing demand for the port to grow? Is that, was that surfacing in 2002?
Well, I think I think there's always opportunity for that, but initially the impetus behind it was the realization that the docks aren't getting any younger. And
good point. We need to talk about this. Is a 50-year-old port.
This is our 50th birthday this year, and the condition of the piles is deteriorating. When you operate in an environment like this in Upper Cook Inlet, as I understand it, is one of the most corrosive environments in the world. Not only because of the salt and the sediment in the water, but because of its turbidity, it's always moving. We see a lot of corrosion on the piles. There's approximately 1,300 pile that hold up the dock.
1,300 individual piles.
Individual piles, and the challenge is every year to stay within the stay within the time you can do construction up here, and keeping the cost reasonable to fix as many of those as you can. If doing it that way, doing maybe a handful every year, 10 to 12, and assuming everything stopped corroding tomorrow, we'd have 10 or 15 years worth of work just to keep up with just the normal corrosion. Cathodic protection, which is putting electric current to steel in the water to help extend the life of it. It's old and not working everywhere anymore, so that only exacerbates the problem.
Let me throw out the numbers. I reintroduced you and forgot to give people the numbers, and I know that they've got questions for you. So it's 550-8433 in Anchorage, or 1-888-353-5752, or you can send us an email to hometown@alaskapublic.org. You know, there are pictures on the port's website. I would encourage people to go there. And you can see some rather scary pictures of pilings. And it is true that parts of this port predate the earthquake. And I sense that there's a sense that if we had a big earthquake, it might fail. So there's a lot of pressure to fix this problem. Am I right?
No, I agree with you. And it is the case. In fact, you know, they cut the ribbon and opened the port in 1961. The 64 earthquake was 3 years later, and you know, part of the reason why the container ships, predominantly Sealand at the time, started coming to Anchorage was because there was no other dock to come to.
Exactly.
And the amount of damage that had to be repaired here was way minimal compared to what it was everywhere else. In fact, every other dock just about fell in the water.
Yeah.
So there was no viable other place to go.
Right.
Yeah. And those relationships, those business relationships, have grown ever since.
I'd like to talk about the design and how it's different from the old design. So we've got the dock on pilings, and then we've got this new design. So run us through that, Steve.
Okay, sure. Well, you know, and you're going to allow me to practice a little engineering without a license.
I
hope Dr. McAllister doesn't get too offended by this.
Let me check that license for you.
Yeah.
I always tell people I'm gonna clep a degree when I get done at the port.
An honorary.
That's right. The current design of the dock is a pile supported structure. It's as we said, there's about 1,300 piles that support the concrete and asphalt driveways that make up the dock, the trestles that come off the land out onto the dock. That's the current design. It's a maintenance challenge in a good environment, and the design that we would like to go to and have started to transition to is something called open cell sheet pile. Now, there's, as I understand it, there's quite a lot of different variations on open cell sheet pile, but suffice to say for this one here, the design is fundamentally a steel bulkhead wall along the water's edge in a scallop shape. And where two scallops come together, there's a tail wall that comes back into the land behind it to help hold that bulkhead wall straight up and to provide the extra structural support that you need behind it. Otherwise, the more you started filling gravel, the more leaning into the water that wall would become. It has to be tied back. That's where the strength comes from. That's where the survivability comes from. And depending upon the composition of the ground the bedrock in the water, those tail walls can be anywhere from 60 to 100 to 200 feet long to give you that tie back strength that you need. Mm-hmm. And then what you do is once you have the cells built, you pack gravel fill material right up against them, and compact it and compact it and compact it, which is kind of like putting flour in a bucket. You know, you put the flour in, you shake the bucket, it all settles down, and you put more in, you can settle down and get more in. It's just fundamentally the same thing we have to do with the ground behind it, and all of that together gives it strength.
Okay. Now, we've got a caller, so it's about the ferry, which is in okay. the port. So we'll come back to the design, but let's take Sylvia. Hello, Sylvia. You're on Hometown Alaska.
Yes. I had a question concerning a ferry that I keep hearing about that has already been built, you know, that takes cars from Anchorage to Kenai. I'm very excited about that because it could keep people off the dangerous roads in the winter and take fishermen and tourists, you know, at different times. And I keep hearing that the only, or one of the only holdups is the dock at the ferry, I mean, dock at the port. And I'm wondering what would need to be done to enable us to put that ferry into service.
Well, that's a really good question, and I hope you got like 40 million listeners.
Okay.
Because this has been one we've been trying to make people understand for a very long time.
Okay.
Back up just before I got to the port, an arrangement was struck between the Mat-Su Borough and the municipality of Anchorage mm-hmm. for us to work together to find a viable, reasonable design for a ferry landing at the port of Anchorage. Mm-hmm. And we invested some money into that effort and spent quite a bit of time going back and forth with designs on how we could not only protect the Port of Anchorage's operation and navigation to and from it, but at the same time make room for the Mat-Su Ferry to be able to dock there. And at the end of the day, and after, you know, 2.5 years of back and forth, the decision was made not by the Port of Anchorage, not by the municipality, but by the Mat-Su Borough, that they couldn't get what they wanted at the port without a whole lot of concession. Their preference, even then, their preference was to put their ferry landing down by the mouth of Ship Creek. Mm-hmm. And they even submitted a permit to the Corps of Engineers to build a ferry landing at Ship Creek. And as I understand it, the Coast Guard is who intervened and put a stop to that because of all the small boat operations in and out of the boat launch down there at Ship Creek, and because that's where the tugboat operation is set up.
Mm-hmm.
So, frankly, it's not for lack of trying.
Mm-hmm.
There was just not a very good engineering solution that made everybody happy. And when I say engineering solution, it's got less to do with how pretty it was going to look and more to do with how safely you could operate it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, good question, Sylvia.
Yeah.
I bet a lot of people are wondering about that. As Steve said, it's one of the questions they get the most of. So thank you for asking it.
Thank you.
We're into the new port design,
yeah.
And I want to throw a question to Larry about whether the Corps ever looked at this design early on and decided we're not going to have anything to do with this. This is too big, too enormous. Or what has your role been up until now in this new port expansion project?
Great question. Many people understand that the Corps of Engineers is responsible for issuing permits for construction. We're given that authority under the Clean Water Act. Anything that's a navigable waterway, the Corps is responsible for making sure that there's minimal environmental damage or that can be mitigated if we're going to do some construction in that particular area. For anybody who's built a dock outside their backway into a river or anything of that nature, I understand that process. Now, this was no different. They're going to do something different into the Kinnick Arm Cook Inlet, and so they had to require a permit. One of the things we have to do to analyze and see whether that permit is going to be viable is I mentioned earlier, we are responsible for the dredging up to within 5 feet of the current dock. We had to make sure that structure was minimally safe so that when we start excavating 35 feet down, that the dock wasn't going to collapse. The new, as you heard, the open cell sheet pile system wasn't going to collapse. We did not do a structural analysis of it. It was more of is this a safe relatively safe design, and if we dredge in front of it, is it going to stay safe?
Mm-hmm.
And then we issued the permit based on our analysis of that and lots of other things, the beluga whales and all that other stuff that goes into that. The Corps issued a permit in 2000, I believe, 2006. And then final permit was issued in June 2008.
And so you were simply saying what to the contractor? You were saying it's okay to...
Here's your permit. That's all we were saying.
Okay.
We didn't report anything on whether this was the best solution or the right solution or an appropriate solution. It was strictly that based on our analysis of the environmental impact, this was a adequate solution for what we needed to do at that time, which was to analyze the environmental impact.
Okay. So let's go to 2009 when the construction's happening, these big steel sheets are being pounded down into the floor, and so problems surface. One question I have for the Corps is, did you have to guarantee what was beneath? In other words, if there were hard rocks under there, was that something you looked at, or you only went up to 5 feet?
We went up to 5 feet.
So whatever they found under there as they started to pound in was theirs to find.
Correct.
Basically. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that's when we really sort of, things kind of took a hard left turn here and we began to have some problems. I don't think people really understand, Steve, how it worked. Could you kind of describe what the process was in 2009? What was going on? How did they pound those things in?
The process uses what they call vibratory hammers or impact hammers, depending upon what the circumstances are at the time. And as you said, two big cranes are involved. They lift the sheet vertically, stand it up. There's a template that's constructed that gives the outline of the cell, the scallop that I mentioned earlier, so that the workers can align the sheets along that shape to keep the shapes consistent. And they interlock together. So one will slide inside an interlock at the end of another. And when it gets down to the bottom, the vibratory hammer begins doing its thing. And slowly but surely, it works the sheet pile down into the earth, into the depth that was required by the design engineers to provide the structural integrity that you need. And then you move on to the next sheet and you do the same thing down the whole line, and then you do the tail walls.
Right.
Yeah.
When they encountered, obviously, eventually, divers went down and looked at what was going on there. Mm-hmm. What did they see? I know it's murky down there. But
well, yeah. I think what began to be discovered was that the sheets had probably hit something harder than just the ground itself and were not, while they looked straight up and down above the waterline, below the waterline, they had curled and the interlocks had torn. Beyond that, we're all anxiously waiting for these final reports to come out so that we can really get our heads around the extent of the damage
right
out there. But anecdotally, that's some of what you've read and some of what you've heard other people say.
Right. Well, you're listening to Hometown Alaska. We've had two terrific guests on so far. Stephen Rebuffo, you just heard our deputy port director speaking. We've had Larry McAllister on from the Army Corps of Engineers. We're going to have Mayor Dan Sullivan with us when we come back from this break. And we'll continue to talk about the port. We'll continue to talk about the expansion, how we're going to pay for it, all those questions. So this is Kathleen McCoy, and you're listening to Hometown Alaska.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Hometown Alaska, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcasts of Hometown Alaska on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Hometown Alaska. Our topic today is the Port of Anchorage, and we've had Stephen Rebuffo, the Deputy Port Director, with us, and we have Larry McAllister with us. You can call and talk to these folks. The number is 550-8433 or 1-888-353-5752, or send us an email to hometown@alaskapublic.org. And now I'd like to welcome Mayor Dan Sullivan, who's just joined us by phone, I guess from City Hall. Is that right, Mayor?
Hey, hi, Kathleen. Yes, I'm here at City Hall. Just finished my regular Wednesday press briefing and glad to be able to join you.
I gather we had double booked you, and you really haven't figured out how to be in two places at the same time. So.
Well, I do have my evil twin, but I try not to let him out too often.
Okay. Well, we're really glad you could participate with us. I wanted to launch you off on the new memorandum of agreement that I obtained from the port. It really changes the relationship in a lot of ways. And so I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about that.
Absolutely. You know, coming into office, one of the first things that landed on our desk was the fact that there were construction problems at the port. And as we investigated over the last 2 years, not only examining the construction itself, but also the oversight of the project, the memorandum of understanding, and quickly realizing that this was really an unacceptable agreement between ourselves and the federal government and their contractors. Quite frankly, it did not provide the level of oversight that was required with a major construction project like this. MARAD did not have a full-time person here managing the project.
Mayor, let's tell people who MARAD is. I haven't really brought them up yet.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I didn't know. I wasn't able to listen to your previous, but they're the Maritime Administration. They're a federal agency.
Out of Washington, D.C., right?
Out of Washington, D.C. And the occasion of not having a full-time person here meant that communication between the city, the port, and the construction project oftentimes was much delayed as we waited for answers from Washington or the regional office. And so the new agreement requires a full-time person here from MARAD. We've also got a new indemnification section that makes sure that if there is any damage, that the port and the city are covered through bonding and liability coverage. So and, of course, then the Project Oversight Committee itself, which consists of representatives from the city, the port, the contractors, and the Maritime Administration. And as Steve may have explained, they meet weekly, and they go over, the previous week's work. They plan future activity. They set timelines and benchmarks, and they ensure quality assurance and quality control, just all those things that you would do with a major construction project that were not done leading up to when we came into office. And so I think we've done a pretty good job over the last couple of years of, A, identifying what the problem is, and B, putting a course of action together that will not only solve the problem, but will allow us to finish the port project and allow the shippers to have some certainty in this very, very important port.
Now, Mayor, I was interested to learn that this is an enterprise department, so it brings in money to the city, so it's absolutely very important. I wondered if that changed your relationship with the port. I know that the port director works for you, but on the other hand, when they're bringing in all the money, is it kind of hard to tell the port what to do?
Well, no, not at all. I mean, the port, we don't look at it as a revenue stream by any means. We look at it as a critical piece of infrastructure for the whole state of Alaska. And you know the statistic. It's oft repeated that, over 85% of all the goods that come into Alaska come in through the Port of Anchorage. So we look at it as, not so much a revenue stream. We certainly have we appreciate the fact that they are a profitable entity, but more importantly, it's just the role it plays not only for the whole state but for the military as well. And we're a very, very important military town. And so I don't look at it in terms of the money. I really look at it in terms of its functionality.
And on that point, I know that the port director does work for you, and there are people, Chris Tuck, various people who've said, boy, somebody's got to pay the price for this mistake. Could the port director's job be at risk over this?
Well, we don't discuss personnel items with the media. If there was an announcement, we certainly would issue a release of some kind, but we certainly don't talk about what could happen with our personnel. That's really not a professional way to deal with your executives.
And, right.
But the fact of the matter is, I think a lot of people have just been misinformed about the role of the port director. His job was to manage the port while MARAD was managing a construction project adjacent to the port.
Mm-hmm.
And quite frankly, he's done a fine job managing the port. The ships have come in and out on time. The goods have got delivered. The fuel that is vital to the military base and to the airport has been transmitted. So, you know, if they're saying that he should be fired because of the way the port's been managed, well, show me where it's been mismanaged.
Mm-hmm.
If they're saying that he should be fired because of the way the construction project's been managed, then they don't understand the fact that he wasn't in charge of the construction
right.
project.
You're in a tough spot because you weren't the mayor when he got the job or when the project began. In my reading, I learned that, you know, the city really didn't have liability insurance under the first arrangement. So those things have been corrected by this new memorandum of understanding. So I guess the question I have now is, it looks like you're going forward with a much smaller version.
Yeah, one of the things that we've done is, I guess, really come to reality that the billion-dollar price tag that it might take to complete all three phases of the port as currently designed is probably not going to be a political reality. I think there's sticker shock when legislators see that number, particularly when, you know, the original price tag was maybe a third of that. And there's lots of reasons why prices go up. Certainly the delays because of construction, delays because of the beluga whales. The price of commodities has risen dramatically. But all that being said, it seemed to me that if we were going to get support from the legislature, we better come up with a new scaled-down design that would not only fit within a price range that we thought we could actually obtain, but would serve the needs of the main shippers, particularly Tote and Horizon. And the redesign of the north end of the port will provide permanent berths for Tote and Horizon. It also provides a new wet barge dock and a dry barge dock. And if somewhere down the road people want to tackle the rest of it, I'm going to leave that to future leaders. But I wanted to give certainty to the shippers, and I wanted to give fiscal certainty to the project. And so we're asking for a $350 million bond, which would probably be combined with other projects around the state, maybe making it more in the $400 million range. And with interest rates as low as they are right now, and with the financial solvency of the state of Alaska, there's no better time to issue port bonds than right now. And we could take care of a lot of critical needs around the state, particularly this port.
Mayor, I'm going to take a call. Bob's online, and he's asking a question about cost increases and oversight. So it sounds like a good mm-hmm. time, Bob, for you to jump in.
Thank you. This is Bob Shavelson with Cook and Light Keeper. And, Mr. Mayor, I appreciate you being on the call.
My organization's
been following the port expansion issue since about 2004. And I have to say what I've heard today is, in a lot of ways, a rewrite of the history. And it's truly been one of the most disturbing public works projects I've ever experienced. And from the start, there's been two things that have amazed us. First, there was never any demonstrated need for a project this large and expensive, and there's certainly no plan to pay for it. And on the second item, we've been alarmed that no one's taken any action to address Bill Sheffield's role as the port director. I mean, Mr. Sheffield came on. There was a proposal to rebuild the dock at $146 million with a pile-supported structure, which all the engineers said would be much more stable in a seismic event. And that was in 2001. It quickly became a $350 million project. Then it rose up to a $1.2 billion project. So in most circumstances, a person like a port director overseeing a 700% cost increase for a capital project would be dismissed. And you talked, you don't want to discuss these things on the air. But my question is,
sure.
Does the fact that Mr. Sheffield holds political fundraisers for you at his house influence your willingness to dismiss him?
Well, you made some erroneous statements, Bob, and you repeated what's been said out there, which I just corrected a moment ago, which is he was not the supervisor of the construction project. The project is being managed by MARAD, the Maritime Administration. Their general contractor, ICRC, is the head of the construction team. Their subcontractors, which there's been various of them now, some who are no longer on the job because, quite frankly, the job wasn't done very well. And so what we have now is, you know, we can look backwards and say, you know, maybe MARAD didn't do as good a job as they should have or the contractors didn't. But what I'm looking at is what is the path forward, and that's why I've scaled down the project design to a manageable level, $350 million. And we know that this design works even in earthquake zones. You know, this exact same design is built several ports in Japan that were right at the forefront of the earthquake, and they survived just fine. So it's how you build it. And West Construction, which is doing the construction Construction now has successfully installed this very same design in numerous ports around Alaska. They just built one in Iraq. It won the International Construction Project of the Year Award. So, you know, you keep trying to lay blame on Bill Sheffield, but again, he is not the manager of the construction project. His job was to manage the port as the construction project was going on around him. And he was as frustrated as anybody else over the inability to communicate with MARAD and express his concerns because of the fact that MARAD did not have a full-time person here, and the general contractor probably, you know, probably should have been a different contractor. So that's where it stands now, and I'm committed to fixing it, and I think we've done a great job of moving forward with that.
Can I just address one other thing? I feel it's unfortunate to try to label Mr. Sheffield as a victim in this whole thing because, again,
Who said he was a victim? I never used the word victim.
He was powerless in his role as port director to address these things were occurring right.
He tried to address them constantly, and that was the problem with MARAD, with nobody here having to deal with Washington, D.C., and wait for communication to come.
He chose a design that had never been used to this extent before. You said all these examples, but never before has a sheet pile design been used with such a large freeboard with so much weight behind it, and that's why, in a large extent, this has failed, according to the engineers that I've spoken to.
Well, that's incorrect. That's incorrect. Let me prove it to you. I'll prove it to you.
You know what?
West Construction has successfully installed this design in numerous locations, and they're successfully installing it at the port right now. And the reason is they are installing from the water side and then gradually adding the dirt later. What the other contractor was doing was pushing out the dirt first and then trying to install a steel wall in front of it, and that was an improper way to install.
So if I could just ask one final question.
Okay, Bob.
My question would be, Mayor, would you agree to a third-party independent review of the engineering and the
It's happening right
aspect?
Now. We have the Corps of Engineers doing that right at this moment. We engaged the Corps and CH2M Hill to review not only what went wrong with the construction to date, but also the design and the engineering. That's happening now. It's part of our reform.
We're talking about an independent third-party review where none of the parties that have had their fingers in this project would actually look at this from a...
Well, both the Corps and CH2M Hill have had no role in this project. They are independent.
And who pays them?
Well, who pays the Corps of Engineers? The Corps of Engineers is federally funded.
I'm talking about no one that's being paid by the Port of Anchorage where there's a vested interest in coming to a predetermined outcome.
The Corps of Engineers is an independent agency, and they are engaged in a totally independent review of the project right now. Corps of Engineers has built ports all over the world. We expect a very detailed, very independent report from the Corps of Engineers.
And actually,
in 2008, we sent a letter to the Corps of Engineers laying out a number of flaws, and despite repeated promises, the Corps has never responded to that letter.
Well, guess what? They're responding to me.
Hey, Bob, actually, I want to get back to the Corps. We have a Corps representative right here who can talk about the oversight project they're doing. So let's hear from him about how they're going to assess this.
Hi, yeah, this is Larry McAllister with the Corps of Engineers. We were engaged about a year ago, approached about a year ago with the city, the port, saying, you know, would you be interested in taking a look at as an independent analysis? Because we mentioned earlier, the only aspect we've ever had with this port is the dredging piece in front of it and the permitting piece of it. So we said, sure, let's take a look at it, but we need to make sure that we approach this from a systematic, purely forensic approach. We are a federal agency. We are a reimbursable organization, which means somebody has to pay our salaries. We don't get money just to maintain our own salaries. So, and because of the Economy Act, we have to work through another federal agency. So MARAD is paying to do this independent analysis. We went through the American Association of Port Authorities to get the best architect engineering firms on record that are worldwide known, world-renowned for knowing how to do forensics on port construction or large construction projects. We went through a bidding process with three major engineering firms. We did select CH2M Hill, as Mayor Sullivan mentioned. We hired them in the end of September to do an independent analysis. We call it a suitability study. Basically, they're taking a complete look at not only the open the whole foundation system. We call it the foundation system, but it's basically the sheet pile and all the stuff that goes with the sheet pile. So that includes the geotechnical, the structural, the seismic, the hydrology, the ice flow, all that stuff they're taking a look at. That report is due in the end of March. which will then be made public after public meetings will be held. Right now, they're in the first phase of that, which is basically gathering all the data that they can from the existing work that's been done. Because it's a very, very short time frame that we're doing this independent analysis, we need to gather all the data that was currently done, the current design, what was used in the seismic analysis, what was used in the structural analysis, all that information, what kind of gravel was put behind there, you know, what was the test done on the compaction, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, what construction techniques were used. The other piece that we're doing, and this is probably one of the little known pieces, that the Corps of Engineers, as been mentioned by the mayor, we do port construction all over the world. We've done port construction all over Alaska as well. We have experts within the Corps of Engineers, experts, world-class experts, that do these sort of construction analysis and techniques of construction. So we have hired some folks out of our research laboratories, and these are world-class research laboratories called Engineering Research and Development Center down in Vicksburg, Mississippi. And they will help us to do a constructability analysis that will look at a lot of other things, not looking at the foundation piece at all, but looking at everything else, the planning, the environmental aspects of it, the constructability, the construction aspect, how well did they do the construction techniques? Was there things that they could have done better? And our recommendations, of course, is what could they have done better? What could be done better in the future? Because we have been asked the possibility to take on the construction from some point in the future on forward. And we need to be able to present to the, we call it the owner group, which is essentially MARAD, the port, and the municipality, of what's the best way forward to do this construction? What is the techniques that should be used going forward from here to complete the rest of the construction so that everybody is a winner on this and we come out with a viable project at the least amount of cost, the least environmentally damaging, and the most structurally seismic sound system.
So everybody wishes you were there in 2002, right? but you were not asked to do it. You did not look at the – you were not asked to perhaps take on this project in 2002?
No, that's not. We were approached about a year ago and said, would you be interested in taking a look at this?
Now in Chapter 2 of the expansion.
Correct.
Not in Chapter 1. It's interesting because you know, I was thinking, gosh, what, too bad this didn't happen sooner, before we lost a life at the port, before, you know, all this money was spent and has to be respent. Now, here's a question. Could the Corps decide that the open cell design does not work in Cook Inlet?
Well,
or is not safe enough or whatever?
Yeah, I would be hesitant to put out a prediction of what these reports are going to come back as.
But, I mean, it is within the realm of what you're considering.
Oh, sure, yeah. Sure. It is a viable system, as Mayor Sullivan mentioned earlier. It is used around the state. It has been used successfully at other
this
places.
Big? Is it used this big?
Not in other places around the state. This is probably one of the largest attempts at this methodology that I'm aware of. But all of that will be put into the factor of, you know, is this the best way going forward? Is this the right design technique? Was this the right construction technique, et cetera, et cetera?
And are you looking at, you know, the smaller version, the northern extension only, or are you looking at the whole thing as if we were talking about the $1 billion project? Or are you only looking at...
We're only looking at the northern end.
The northern end.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Well, lots... And when is your report due?
The final draft of the suitability study by the architect engineering firm CH2M Hill is due by the end of March. The second piece of it, which is the future of the constructability, the planning, the engineering processes, we're looking at probably the end of April, middle of May timeframe, be ready to make a present a formal decision to the assembly, et cetera, probably by the end of May.
Wow. And I think I read, Mayor, in your memorandum of agreement that by May, it's likely to be a change away from MARAD for sure. Is that right?
We've had discussions with both MARAD and the and their contractors that at the end of May we have the opportunity to reevaluate the relationship, and we do have the opportunity to make changes at that time. It's likely that MARAD would still remain the federal agency through which money would pass through, but the actual oversight of construction would be transferred somewhere else, whether it's to the Corps or to another group, still
right.
To be determined.
And actually, with this new memorandum of agreement, I think there's more than one review going on. Am I right? I think there's a review of MARAD going on by the U.S. Department of Transportation.
Yeah, in fact, they visited us a couple of months ago, and they are doing an internal audit, if you will, of the construction practices and the management, yes.
Yeah. So, and I also had the impression when I toured the port that West Construction, which has continued, has gone back in and is actually still installing these sheets on the northern extension successfully, that they were supportive of this design as well. But people criticize that because they're working for the port, so wouldn't they want to say it works? But I'm just wondering, what did they do differently than the first contractor? Do you know?
Yeah, I do, and I started to touch on that when Bob was on. Number one, they support the design because they've built this exact design in other locations, including, as I mentioned, a very, very large port in Iraq for which they won the International Construction Project of the Year Award. Same sheet pile design and a large, large port, so we know it can be done on both a small and large scale. But what they do is, as I mentioned, they install the sheet pile from the water side, not from the land side. And so they successfully install the sheet pile first, and then they gradually fill in the land behind it so that you're not trying to install sheet pile up against a lot of pressure from a lot of gravel that's basically trying to, you know, through gravity, you know, that tries to move, and you're trying to install up against it. So they install the sheet pile first, and then they slowly fill in behind it. That technique has proven to be very successful. They have successfully installed sheet pile in the areas where other contractors were not successful.
But, so Mayor, did they also drill? Did they drill, which was different from what the original contractor did?
I think they've prepped the area to which the sheet pile is being installed better, sure.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, I tell you, it must have been amazing to become the mayor and then realize this thing was developing and on your watch, so to speak.
Sure. Well, this is one of numerous challenges we inherited, but you just have to move forward and find the best solution, and we have really worked very, very hard over the last 2 years.
Hey, I have one more question for you, though, because I'm sorry. Are we going to get our money back?
I hate to jump into legal things. There is some legal action going on between the various parties involved in the construction, and there's a lot of finger-pointing going on, but we'll let the courts kind of determine that. I'd hate to predict one way or the other. But one thing people forget, too, though, is that of the amount of money spent to date, a lot of good work has been done.
Steve made. Actually, there's a lot of on-land work. The railroad was extended. I don't know. What other things?
Facilities installed, acres, basically a whole bunch of new acreage created. So once the facing and that part gets done, there is an awful lot of work that's been successfully completed down there at the port. And, it's going to be quite an asset when it's all done.
Yeah. Well, we'll all be glad when it's all done. Right. And I mean, as we talked about it, this port is so essential. I think I read a description. It's not that it's too big to fail. It's too important to fail. Right.
That was my quote, yes.
Yeah.
I hate talking about projects that are banks or institutions that are too big to fail, but quite frankly, this project is too important to fail.
Yeah. Well, listen, we just have a little bit of time left. I wanted just to thank our two guests who were in the studio. First of all, thank you, Mayor, for taking the time out to call and take some hot questions here about the port, which is,
you bet.
You know, you're the mayor. That's what you get to do.
I love it.
And I want to thank Stephen Ribuffo, the deputy port director, who came down and answered questions, and Dr. Larry McAllister from the Army Corps of Engineers. Thank you very much. You guys did a great job. It was good. We've had a great hour discussing the Port of Anchorage and its complex expansion project. Thanks to my guests, Stephen Ribuffo and Larry McAllister and Mayor Dan Sullivan. Next week, Hometown Alaska takes a break for the holiday but returns the following Wednesday, December 29th, when host Peter Dunlap-Scholl talks about volunteers with guests from United Way and Big Brothers Big Sisters. Please connect with us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Alaska Public. Pat Yak is Vice President of Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.